Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies, Miss Bala, They Shall Not Grow Old, Velvet Buzzsaw, and finally, I had a chance to check this one out. I'll be talking about The Kid Who Would Be King. I'll also be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Nutcracker and the Four Realms and Doctor Who Season 11. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I have to address is a sad rest in peace to Dick Miller. He died this week at age 90. Now, most people would not know the name Dick Miller. Dick Miller was a character actor going all the way back into the 50s and 60s. He worked on a lot of Roger Corman movies, but you would probably recognize him. He's been in a bunch of films and somewhat recognizable elements. Like in Terminator, he's the guy, he's the gun shop owner. In the movie Gremlins, he is the old kind of crotchety snowplow driver who's actually a spinoff of his character, because his wife in that is also played by his co-star from Little Shop of Horrors. He was the guy in the original Little Shop of Horrors who would eat the flowers. He'd come into the Mushnick flower shop so he could eat the flowers. And he, of course, his wife in the Gremlins movie played Audrey, the original Audrey in Little Shop of Horrors. Pretty much anything from Roger Corman. He also did a bunch of even starring roles in like A Bucket of Blood, this goofy beatnik comedy horror movie that Corman directed. Dick Miller was a character actor, and he was very recognizable. They even did a film about him several years ago as one of those that guys that everyone recognizes for movies, but a lot of people didn't know who he was. And it's sad to see him go, and he will be missed as a character actor. The next piece of news really isn't news, but it's a little bit of a sound off from listeners about my comments last week about the Cheese Whiz story, about the woman who was brought Cheese Whiz into the movie theater and was putting it on crackers and everything. So I actually had a couple people write in and respond to this with their own tales. The first one comes from John from Ohio, and he talks about how he went to go see Lord of the Flies in the early 90s. That was when the remake was done. They had the original one from, I think, the 60s, which was the black and white. This was a much slicker version of Lord of the Flies. And it's at the scene where Piggy gets killed, and the effects weren't, they were a little almost silly at the time. And so even though the theater was full and it was quiet, there was a, it was an intense scene, but emotional scene, but also could be taken out of context. And somebody, as he says, quote, then somebody in the front row starts to laugh loudly. And after a second or two, you hear whoever he is with yell at him, that's not funny, whatever his name was, and slaps him. You know, after another second of silence, the entire theater cracked up laughing. Because that happens. I mean, you can get something that happens that's funny in a theater. I mean, that's not somebody putting Cheese Whiz on a cracker, but it is. It weirdly disrupts the movie, even if it's a genuine response. He also tells about a story how he went to go see Addams Family Values in the 90s and saw an OSU football player there, and I guess that caused a big hubbub. I remember one of the screenings I went to, the quarterback for OSU came to the screening. He'd gotten a ticket, and he came in with a date. And everyone's like, oh, is that so? I don't know who it was. I don't pay attention to football. I know this is the weekend that you're supposed to pay attention to football. I don't pay attention to football at all. I'm not a football guy. I didn't even know who this guy was when he walked in. But like everybody else in the theater thought it was a big deal because the OSU quarterback showed up. Now, there was another story that came in from Chris from Florida. And first of all, you got to understand, Chris is blind. He's written to the show before, but he's blind, and he had lost his sight over the years, so he had gone to movies when he was younger, but he still likes to go to movies, and blind people can absolutely enjoy a movie experience. They have these things called descriptive video services, and you'll find them. You can click through them on a DVD or Blu-ray. Oftentimes, it's embedded in all the features where it describes what's going on screen, so you're not just left with just the noisy soundtrack. And it's a great service, and it's getting more more and more use out there, which is great because, you know, blind people can enjoy movies. Absolutely. But Chris wrote me and told me about the fact that there was this woman who would come in, and Chris was also in a wheelchair, by the way. He's in a big electric wheelchair. And in most theaters, they have a companion seating section where there's an empty area for a wheelchair to be pulled in, and then the companion can sit next to them so they don't have to be split up. But apparently there was this woman who was sitting in the companion seating alone. And they asked if they could take the seat because he had his actually had his aide with him. And she says, well, I can't move because there's no more empty seats. And his aide was like kind of annoyed with him. It's like, well, yeah, you're awesome. Even though she could have moved because there were other seats in the theater. She just didn't want to give up her own. What's cool about it, it's a nice little story at the end, is the AMC manager took Chris and his family and put them in their own theater by themselves so they can enjoy the movie without this rude woman sitting next to him, which I think is fantastic. That's one of those like little stories that gives you a faith in humanity, that there are still nice people in the world doing the right thing. And you know what? If I can restore a little bit of faith in humanity with this show, that's a wonderful thing. So thanks both Chris and John for writing in and telling some of your theatrical experiences while going to the movies. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is The Beach Bum, which opens on March 22nd.
It all stops now. The foolishness.
You gotta publish your novel.
And if you mess this up, it's jail time.
Wish me luck. I'm off to write the next great American novel.
I'm trying to uncover my connection with the world.
Just follow me, my friend. Let's go, man.
Is he a good pilot?
Oh, man, you got glaucoma in both his eyes.
This is Harmony Korine's latest movie. If you don't know who that is, he's best known recently for doing the film Spring Breakers. And there are some people who absolutely love that movie. I didn't. I thought it was stupid. I mean, it's best. I think it was somewhat of a pretentious exercise. It was not a good movie, but it got enough notice for him to make this other one. And this one looks even worse. It looks like Matthew McConaughey playing the character he's known for, sort of the, hey, what's up, man, kind of drug guy from Dazed and Confused after 20, 30 years, and he's living on a beach. And I mean, it looks like it's well shot. It might have some funny moments, but it looks like all the worst parts of Spring Breakers crammed into a movie that really doesn't have much of a plot or a story or development. And it's just Korine being like, I'm going to be edgy, even though he's not, because he's doing the same playing the hits that he's been doing for years. I don't know. This movie, I don't hold a lot of faith on this one. The next one I want to cover really quickly is A Dog's Journey, which opens on May 17th.
This is CJ, the greatest new addition to our pack.
Doggy, doggy, doggy.
I love mornings with our granddaughter.
So did I. Mostly because she gave me bacon. Pretty soon, CJ had to move away.
Let us know where you wind up.
You've done so much for me. When you come back the next time, take care of CJ. She needs you like I needed you.
And then it happened. I was a puppy again, and CJ was my new purpose. She was a gigantic baby now.
This is a sequel to A Dog's Purpose, not A Dog's Way Home, which came out just a couple weeks ago. Dog's Purpose was the one a couple years ago where Josh Gad played the voice of the dog that would reincarnate into different dogs and live throughout its life, and Dennis Quaid was his owner. And this is continuing that story of that dog, Bailey, getting reincarnated and then taking care of Dennis Quaid's grandchild. This looks fine. I mean, it looks like it might be almostly deliberately button pushy. It's one of those that's going to, like, dog lovers are going to love it. It's sort of for that family friendly Hallmark type of movie audience, which I only can take so much of that because it gets a little bit too sweet and saccharine. But probably if you loved A Dog's Purpose, you're probably going to like this one when it comes out in May. And that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Velvet Buzzsaw and The Kid Who Would Be King.
Fat
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some new movie reviews. The first one is Velvet Buzzsaw. A woman who works in a high-class art gallery discovers a collection of paintings by a dead artist and starts to sell them, only to discover the paintings can be quite deadly.
Who did these? Mesmeric.
Guy upstairs, he died.
And you just took them?
He had no family or friends.
I can make you rich.
It's brilliant.
Demand has people ready to kill.
Have you ever heard of an artist named Ventral D's?
No, not in our records, and we have everyone.
The artist used blood to create the reddish blocks.
You ever notice anything about this painting? You look at it long enough, it moves.
This is directed by Tony Gilroy, who has written a whole bunch of movies going all the way back to Free Jack. But he also started directing films, and he did Nightcrawler several years ago. That's the one where Jake Gyllenhaal played a smarmy videographer who was trying to get into the news journalism, the sort of like the sensational life type, ripped from the headlines types of video. It's an interesting nihilistic look at fame and success, and if it bleeds, it leads kind of idea that sometimes news organizations can get wrapped up in. He did Roman J. Israel Esquire. I believe that was last year with Denzel Washington. Not a good movie. Got some buzz for Denzel, but it didn't hold together as a film. This is his follow-up to that. And what's problematic about this movie is actually it comes out on Netflix. It's in limited theatrical release, but it's on Netflix right now. You can watch it if you have the service. And here's where I think it's going to run into problems. Because of its structure, when you start to watch this movie, the catch, the whole thing that these paintings, that there's something in them that is evil and can come out and attack people and can hurt people, you don't even get that for an hour. It reminds me a little bit of that movie Serenity last week, where I said the first half of that movie was just this boring story about this drunken fishboat captain. It takes like 45 minutes in that movie to get to anything kind of interesting, to get to the weird twist that goes on with it. Similarly with this movie, Velvet Buzzsaw is just about pretentious a-holes running art galleries. Jake Gyllenhaal plays a critic, and he's mean and just awful to everybody. And I think that there's also a certain degree of Gilroy grinding his gears about critics, especially after something like Roman J. Israel Esquire. But he is sort of venting his spleen on critics in this movie. But it's also the pretentious life of these art gallery people. And then there's John Malkovich plays one of the artists who is kind of burned out and has lost his creative ideas. But that's what half the movie is just these boring lives and these people who are, they're unappealing. They're not good characters. I mean, you either have to have a character that you like, that you genuinely like and are good people, or they have to be characters that you like to see have bad things happen to them, that people you like to hate. But they're neither in this one. They're not interesting enough or likable enough to kind of root for, but they're also not dastardly and awful enough to root against. You're just kind of like, I don't care what happens to any of these people. And that's a terrible setup to have for a movie where these people are getting killed by paintings, essentially. The problem that this is going to face, as opposed to Serenity last week, is in Serenity, you had to get in the theater. So you had to pay your money and get in there. And if you stayed for the 45 minutes and saw the interesting twist, you could have also left early, but you paid. So why not stick around? No one's paying directly to watch Velvet Buzzsaw. Most people are going to watch it on Netflix. And where's like Bird Box? That was one that drops on Netflix from the opening scene. It shows that there's something crazy going on that you want to know more about. That's not the way it is with Velvet Buzzsaw. Velvet Buzzsaw, you take an hour. It literally does take like an hour to get to the point where you're like, oh, this is actually something might be happening here. Or at least 45 minutes. But the way Netflix works is people are going to watch it. And if it's not interesting in 15, 20 minutes, they're going to just turn it off. Because they're going to be like, no harm, no foul. In fact, I'm losing money by spending time with a boring movie when I can move on to something else that I've already paid for. And I think that's what Velvet Buzzsaw is going to run into. This is a great example of where I think the movie doesn't work in this format, because the way the streaming works, you have to have a movie that makes people want to continue it earlier on. People will be more forgiving for a slower beginning in the movie theaters. But at this point, you got to stop them from changing the channel, essentially. And ultimately, Velvet Buzzsaw, even when it does get interesting with the ideas, it's just you didn't care about the characters. There's a great little Twilight Zone-esque story in here, and there's a lot of stuff that I think that Gilroy's trying to put in that's esoteric, and he has something to say about art, and he has something to say about critics, and he has something to say about money, and he has something to say about monetizing disaster and pain, and he has something to say about the nature of fame and notorious works, but it's all kind of wrapped up in this pretentious nonsense movie. So I'm going to have to say Velvet Buzzsaw kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with a review of The Kid Who Would Be King. A school kid discovers that he is destined to wield Excalibur and defeat the sorceress Morgana.
Bettis, you've got to see what I found.
There's something written on the card. Put it into Google Translate.
It means Sword of Arthur.
What if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's Excalibur?
Ah, finally. Follow me.
I am Merlin.
In 4 days, the dark sorcerer Morgana will take over the world.
Awaken my warriors.
Am I supposed to stop her? That's ridiculous.
I didn't get to see this movie last week. I tried, but they didn't do Thursday night screening, so I couldn't see it before the weekend. The earliest you could have seen it was like on Friday. And normally when a movie is not screened widely and then doesn't have Thursday night screenings, that's a terrible idea. That means the movie's terrible. But I said, there's something about this. This is actually getting some good reviews. I want to go check this out. So I went to go see it midweek. It was on a day off, so they're filled with kids because they weren't in school. But I got to tell you, this is a great little movie. It's directed by Joe Cornish, who did Attack the Block, and he has a real good sense of making a movie unique and accessible, but also fantastic at the same time. It's clever. You've got some well-rounded characters in the sense that you got the kid and his friend build bonds with their bullies and figure out a way to make their own little Knights of the Round Table. It's got a neat little message there. They've got this kid playing Merlin, as who's now a teenager because he ages in reverse, with Patrick Stewart doing the older version of Merlin. And it's a great little quest that has a whimsical element to it, but also has some real peril. And this movie is an inspirational film. It really is a great movie that I think is something more than just kids are going to like. And even kids, I think little kids, you know, like grade school kids are going to like it. Middle school kids could like it. I think even high school kids could get behind it, but adults can like it too. There's a lot of fun in this. And unfortunately, the studio pigeonholed this into this goofy, unmarketable British kids movie when it could be so much more, because they didn't do that with like Harry Potter, but with all the other failed Harry Potter ripoffs, they were too afraid to spend the money or get behind this when they really should have. And this isn't like so steeped in British elements that it's inaccessible to an American mainstream. It totally is. So The Kid Who Would Be King defies the rule that unscreened and non-previewed movies are terrible. This is actually quite good. I'm going to have to say this totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Miss Bala and They Shall Not Grow Old. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the new movies that are out this week. The first one being Miss Bala. An LA teenager gets caught up between a Mexican cartel and the DEA when she tries to find her friend who went missing during a shootout in Tijuana.
Hey, Merrick. From Los Angeles.
I just want to find my friend.
I need you to do a favor for me first. You mess around and I'll kill you both.
Park the car real close to the curb.
Is this you?
You have to believe me. They made me do it.
building that you blew up is a DEA safe house. You know how long you'll go away for? Unless you help us.
There was a part of me that was kind of excited to see this movie simply because I like sort of the escapist action movies. I'm into that, especially this time of year after all the significant award films and we're heading up to Oscar weekend. I kind of want to see what things are like, you know, without all the hype and something that's kind of just a garbage movie. And sometimes the action movies that come out in January and February can be kind of fun, at least in a disposable thrill. You know, it's like something by Jason Statham. A couple of years ago, they did a bunch of Schwarzenegger and Stallone movies in early January, February. So that's what I was kind of hoping with this one. And I also think it'd be great to see Gina Rodriguez kind of blow up. I think she's a good actor. I think she needs the right vehicle. I don't think this was necessarily that for her. I think she could be that unlikely heroine who can really kind of, you know, kick a lot of butt on screen. The problem with this movie is it's incredibly inconsistent and it doesn't spotlight her properly. There's a lot of scenes of her just looking upset and harrowed and worried and freaking out. And that gets old after a certain amount of time. You want her to sort of harden up, and it just takes her a little longer to harden up than you really want in a movie like this. The other thing is there's a certain logical issue I have with this, and I know it's just a stupid action movie. But even this I had trouble overlooking. Why would the cartel trust her? They trust her, like they strap all this cash to her at one point and want her to move cocaine across the border, and they put her in the most obvious giant SUV, and then they want her to go back and forth over the border, and I'm like, don't they keep track of the passports? I would imagine it would be a red flag if somebody crosses the border a couple times in a day. And then she has to bring guns back over, and they're just in boxes in the back of this SUV. She gets into Mexico, no problem. I'm like, really, seriously, these unmarked cardboard boxes aren't a dead giveaway that there's something. They're not going to search those. I drove over the Hoover Dam once with my family. I had two little kids with me in a Saturn and we got searched. So I don't know. What's the red flag here? You'd think that this would be, they'd be like, unmarked boxes in this giant SUV with Mexican plates and this woman from LA is driving. That's not going to be a tip off. But why would they trust an unproved asset? And then the DEA comes in and is like, we need you to do something for us. You're going to plant this. You're asking just somebody who's like a makeup artist in Hollywood. Doesn't make any sense. And it's just like, I keep thinking, like, what's so special about her that everybody keeps relying on her for this stuff? It's directed by Catherine Hardwicke, which is an interesting thing because nowhere on the marketing does it say from the director of Twilight. And that should be a tip off to you to show how poorly Twilight has lived because no one now wants to claim credit for it. Certainly not the woman who was the first one to direct the first Twilight movie and bring that phenomenon to the big screen. She's sort of shunning that, wants to hide that behind her. The other thing with this movie is I also don't know how long the movie takes. There are certain parts of it where you think it just happens over a couple days because, you know, she's looking for her friend and then she gets kidnapped by this cartel and then she changes her clothes like twice and it looks like it seems to move very, very fast. But then her friend's kidnapped and she's like, oh, they sold me to the traffickers and they've had me doing stuff in the way. And she's like, I got a tattoo that marks her. And I'm like, how long has she gone? I mean, it's like a long weekend. And it's not to say that movies can't play around with the time dilation, but this one smacks you in the face every chance it gets. And on top of it, you know, very similar to Velvet Buzzsaw, there's nobody in this movie I particularly liked as a character. I mean, even her, I just got tired of her at times doing insanely stupid things. And then that big boring part in the middle, this just doesn't feel like a major motion picture. I'd like to see Gina Rodriguez do more. She needs a better vehicle than this. This is something you might have seen on cable in the 90s. So I'm going to have to say Miss Bala kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about They Shall Not Grow Old. Peter Jackson directs this unique documentary about World War I with restored and enhanced footage that's more than 100 years old.
I was 16 years old and my father allowed me to go.
I was just turned 17 at the time.
I was 16.
and I was 15 years.
When they came to us, they were frightened children and had to be made into soldiers.
All right, boys, here it comes. We're in the pictures.
I gave every part of my youth to do a job.
Jackson was approached by the Imperial War Museum in Britain to take all this footage and make a documentary out of it. And instead of just going this normal History Channel route of saying, show the herky-jerky black and white footage and have historians and relatives be talking heads throughout this, he also went and got this archived audio interviews that they'd had with people that were in their, at the time, 60s and 70s, all these veterans talking about it. And they had like 600 hours of those interviews. And then they take the footage and they correct for time, because all that stuff was hand cranked back then. And that's why whenever you look at old footage from 100 years ago, it either moves too fast or too slow. It's because it wasn't a 1-to-1 projection ratio, because they didn't have a portable motor at the time. You had to use your hand. So they correct for timing, so it looks like it's moving at the right speed. Then they enhance it digitally, and they colorize it, and they make it in 3D. And that gives it a unique look to this film, with footage that you've never seen like this before. And also, instead of making it a talking head documentary, he doesn't go by names and dates. He just puts the interviews overlaying what's happens, and he kind of takes people through the process of a soldier going through basic training and going through the horrors of trench warfare and all the things they had to deal with in the field. And then, of course, as they leave the war, what they're dealing with as they're going home and the war's ending. And it's incredibly eye-opening and incredibly powerful. It's harrowing at times and brutal, how all these horrible things that made trench warfare such a horrible experience, you actually get to see it in a lot of ways. And you see the explosions and things that are captured by real cameramen back during the war, which is fascinating to watch. There's something to note, though. It is in 3D, but you need to go to a theater. If you're going to go see this, you got to go see it in a theater that is doing proper projection. And here's a greater problem that I have with 3D, not the process, but the theaters, because it's going to a push button system. Any idiot can plug in a hard drive, push the right code and project. But if they don't have the right filter and the right lens on and everything, it's going to look terrible. And I sat and watched this movie in a room full of cinemaphiles and film critics and the reps who were pushing the movie, one of whom had already seen it before, and it looked terrible. For whatever reason, and I'm not a projectionist, but they didn't have the right filter or they didn't have the right lens, and you're getting a double image. The 3D wasn't popping like it should. And an entire room of people, no one said anything. Even the reps who should know didn't say anything, didn't recognize that there was a problem. Peter Jackson would have lost his mind if he saw how that was pretty. It should be crisp and clear. Any 3D movie nowadays should look crisp and clear. You shouldn't get a double image. If you're getting a double image, or if it's too dark, it's being poorly projected. And the problem is nobody says anything. So if you're going to go somewhere and it doesn't look right, go ask for your money back or get to another theater that projects it properly. Because this is worth being seen, but it needs to be seen properly. They Shall Not Grow Old totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring The Nutcracker in the Foreign Realms and Doctor Who Season 11. At the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we've done the movie reviews, let's jump into the box office and look at last week, which was kind of an underwhelming box office weekend. It's probably also going to be underwhelming this weekend because the Super Bowl is this weekend, which pretty much writes off most of Sunday. I guess you could go see a movie earlier in the day, like a 10 o'clock or noon movie. But the Super Bowl is, what, 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and everyone's doing parties, and everyone's getting ready for that. And it's not that everybody watches the Super Bowl, but a lot of people do. There's people who don't care about sports that'll watch the Super Bowl just for the commercials. The Super Bowl is one of those things that even if you don't care about the Super Bowl, you'll find yourself at a Super Bowl party now and then. I know I've done that, and I don't care about sports. But last weekend, it was a little bit slow. Glass topped the box office again, had about a 50% drop, made just under $19 million, which is fantastic. It's doing very, very well for itself, well over the original production budget. The Upside came in second with $12 million. Again, holding incredibly well, just dropped about 20%. And that one is certainly doing better. It's overcome its own budget. Aquaman's still out there with about $7 million. It's well over $300 million. It's over $1 billion worldwide. And then The Kid Who Would Be King, it came in fourth, but it was the highest grossing new release that week. You should go see that again this week. Try and keep it there. Try and see if you can at least get this thing to sustain a very, very small drop. And then Serenity came in eighth. Not very good, with just $4.4 million for the weekend, which is way less than it should have been with two Oscar winners in the lead roles. Talk about it being a flop of a film. Nobody cared about this movie when it came out last week. Fewer are going to care about it this week. Like I said, go see The Kid Who Would Be King. Miss Bala is probably going to do marginally okay. But again, you know, you're fighting against Super Bowl weekend. I think the World War I movie, They Shall Not Grow Old, should have a decent specialty box office, but do not look for it to break any box office records. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first movie I want to talk about is The Nutcracker and the Four Realms from Disney, releasing this week on DVD and Blu-ray. The characters of the Nutcracker fantasy world return when Clara, the daughter of the original girl from the story, crosses over and helps to free them.
Where am I?
You're in the Four Realms, Princess Clara.
Princess?
Welcome to our world, the land of snowflakes, the land of flowers, and the land of sweets. But in the fourth realm, this is where our troubles began. Mother Ginger started this war.
Don't you know it's dangerous here?
I hope you'll be the one to finish it.
You know, this is a difficult movie to watch right now simply because it's after Christmas. It's a month after Christmas or more. So you do kind of feel like the person who has the Christmas tree still up and you haven't taken down the because this movie drips in Christmas. It's such an odd thing. I never got to see this movie at bonafide Christmas season because when they screened it, it was in October. It was like literally the day before Halloween. So I was still in horror movie Halloween mode and I'm watching with this movie and it just drips in Christmas and it's beautifully done. But I feel like I kind of want to revisit this in about 10 months when I can actually enjoy it as a Christmas movie, because now it's like, it seems silly to watch a Christmas movie in January, no matter how cold it is, no matter about polar vortexes and 6-inch snowfalls. I mean, it looks more like Christmas out right now in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, than it did at Christmas. But still, this just feels a little disingenuous. But I mean, it's a fine movie, but it's certainly a Christmas movie. It's something that I think should be seasonal. I really think Disney probably should have waited to release this in like October or November on DVD and Blu-ray. It's just, I think they always want to have that very, very short window. I mean, it's a beautifully done movie. It's a nice little family movie. A lot of it reminds me of what it was like when I was a kid and I go to my grandparents and it would be the right before Christmas and we'd be watching like television specials, which arguably now you look back and are pretty low rent and terrible. But I'm talking about stuff from the 70s and 80s where everybody had holiday specials. Places were decorated. It was cold because we go to Cleveland. It was usually snowy. And my like great aunt would bring out candy dishes with peppermint patties and Hershey Kisses and the Hershey's mini bars that were all had special wrapping for Christmas, and there'd be pumpkin bread and there'd be home cooked meals. That's the kind of stuff that reminds me of what this movie was like. It does have a warm feeling to it. It's a neat little family film. I mean, I have to say I enjoyed it. And the Blu-ray actually has some okay stuff. It's not loaded with special features. It's got a spotlight on Misty Copeland, who's of course in the movie and has a dancing spotlight in the film over the credits. It has a general behind the scenes look, and there's also a couple music videos and deleted scenes. So it's not completely empty in terms of a Blu-ray DVD release, but if you get it now, hold it on your shelf and watch it at Christmas time, because I think it'll be perfect to watch at that time. So I'm still going to have to say the Nutcracker in the Four Realms kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Doctor Who Season 11. The Doctor returns to the small screen, starring Jodie Whittaker as the first woman to ever play the role.
I'm the Doctor. When people need help, I never refuse. What do we do?
Why are you asking her?
Because she's in charge, bro.
Says who?
Says us.
Let's get a shift on. Sometimes I see things need fixing. Do what I can. I made it through the darkest
part of the night. This was a big deal when they announced Jodie Whittaker originally, and then they had her at the tail end of the Christmas special, and now they've got her in the new role, and you get to see her as the Doctor, and even though they've been aired since October, you now can take it home on your own and get the DVD and Blu-ray. Jodie Whittaker, I actually think she's quite good as the Doctor. It's different. It takes a lot to get used to her, not just because she's a woman, but more that we had Peter Capaldi, who was an older man who had a very different approach. Whereas like David Tennant, even Christopher Eccleston moved to David Tennant, moved to Matt Smith. They all kind of had that same young, attractive, hyperkinetic Doctor Who approach. And Jodie Whittaker certainly does channel that. I think if they would have had her in Peter Capaldi's space, it would have been an easier transition. It's just that they've gone up to Peter Capaldi and you just got used to the old sort of old fart Doctor Who, and then you have to come back down to a younger Doctor Who, male or female. And she does her best to not mimic Matt Smith or David Tennant. She pushes a little closer to David Tennant in her mannerisms, but I think she makes a fine Doctor Who, and I think over the course of the season, she's getting her feet wet, and it's always tough because she also gets new companions this season. So they're restarting everything, which is good, because I think that kind of held back Peter Capaldi from really setting the stage as himself, because they carried over Clara from Matt Smith, and the companion didn't quite have the same chemistry with the Doctor between the shifts, as opposed to Rose going from Christopher Eccleston to David Tennant. It was a much better transition between those two. So it was good that they just kind of started off fresh. They got these new companions, and they're pretty good. And one thing that they are starting to do in this season is they are trying to go back to what original Doctor Who was meant to be, was a little bit of an educational thing, learning a little bit of history. It has a certain amount of cultural outreach to it. They have one of the characters is a Pakistani character, a Pakistani girl, and they go back into her history in one episode where they look at the history of the split of India and Pakistan and sort of what that means in the small scale and the large scale. So it does have certain elements of cultural outreach and history, which is what the original Doctor Who was meant to do. Originally, Doctor Who was conceived to help teach kids a little bit of history, but also be a science fiction show. And that's how this one works. Like I said, it takes a while for her to get her feet wet, but after a couple episodes, she kind of falls into the role a bit better, and she's kind of making it her own, and we're getting some of those episodes that are good old-fashioned Doctor Who, Peril in a Spaceship, monster episodes that are what I always have enjoyed. As much as, you know, the cultural outreach and history stuff is good, but I don't want an entire season of that, and they do bounce around between those as much. I still think there's a little more fleshing out that needs to be done with the new Doctor Who as Jodie Whittaker's role, because they're spending a lot of time getting to know these companions, which is good, but we still need to get to know how the new Doctor is framing the rest of her life before her, and we have yet to see more of that. But I'm going to have to say Doctor Who Season 11 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other releases this week include Suspiria, one of my favorite movies from last year, Hunter Killer, which I never saw, Boy Erased, and The Wife. And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Lego Movie 2, What Men Want, Cold Pursuit, and The Prodigy. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.